Were we on 12? Have I talked about 12 at all yet? Okay, I'm going to still talk a little bit about it. We're basically halfway through the process of gene expression, because there's two parts to that, right? What are the two parts? Transcription and translation. Transcription, we've already talked about. That is the part that involves DNA. The product of that is mRNA, which in eukaryotes needs to be modified post-transcriptionally before it can be used in translation. But translation is the part of gene expression in which the polypeptide is actually built, one amino acid at a time, using the ribosome, the little molecular machine that ensures that the correct amino acids are added in the right order and the right number of them. Well, that is because of the information that's in messenger RNA, the transcript. It tells the ribosome how many amino acids and which ones to put in each place. There are messenger RNA, of course, is RNA, but there are multiple kinds of RNA involved in the translation process. In addition to messenger RNA, there is ribosomal RNA, rRNA, and that's just one of the chemical components of the brown ribosome in this picture. The other component is protein. So protein and rRNA make up ribosomal subunits. And importantly, there's also transfer RNA, which is the teal-colored bent pegs in the cartoon version. They are responsible for actually bringing the amino acids to the ribosome so that they can be strung together to form the polypeptide. And speaking of tRNA, there are multiple versions of tRNA. Each of these little pegs is one tRNA. It's one strand of RNA nucleotides. But although there are millions of these tRNAs, they're not all the same. There are different categories of tRNA corresponding to the different kinds of amino acids. How many biological amino acids are there?
20.
Well, any individual tRNA is only ever allowed to be directly attached to one kind of amino acid of the 20. And no other kind. This is really important because this maintains the integrity of the information. It ensures that only the correct amino acid, the one that corresponds to the codon that's being read at the moment by the ribosome, gets brought in, and none of the other 19. But although there are many different kinds of tRNA, because there's many different kinds of amino acids, we can categorize tRNAs into two major groups based on what they are doing at any given moment. So this has nothing to do with the fact that there are different kinds. What I mean here is that a tRNA is either charged or uncharged at any given moment. So those are the two major categories. And charged here has nothing to do with polarity, electrical charge. We say that a tRNA is charged, or let me start with uncharged. We say that a tRNA is uncharged if it is not connected to any amino acid. So these ones, this one that is leaving the ribosome and this one that left a little bit earlier, those are uncharged tRNAs. It's a complete tRNA molecule. It's just not connected to an amino acid. All right, so that's one possibility. The only other possibility, of course, is that the tRNA is charged. It is connected to an amino acid. And although that's true for all the other ones that have an amino acid connected to them, there's two possibilities. There's two subcategories of charged tRNAs. If a tRNA is charged, but it is connected to specifically one, exactly one amino acid, then we call it
more specifically than saying it's a charged tRNA, we say that it's an aminoacyl tRNA.
So this one bringing glycine in to the codon that's on the right here, that is an aminoacyl tRNA. So are all the other ones that have just one amino acid connected to it. The fact that it's carrying exactly one amino acid. So it's one way, it's one kind of charged tRNA, aminoacyl tRNA. But notice this one that's in the middle of the ribosome. It's connected to phenylalanine directly, but then phenylalanine is connected to tryptophan and so on. It's carrying, instead of amino acid, this tRNA in the middle is carrying a peptide of some length. Two or more amino acids linked together, in other words. And so we call those charged tRNAs peptidyl tRNAs. Okay? Both of these are charged, but they differ in the number of amino acids being carried. Now, importantly, even a peptidyl tRNA, which by definition is carrying multiple amino acids, can only ever be directly connected to one amino acid. And it has to be the only kind of amino acid that that particular tRNA is allowed to carry. No tRNA is ever allowed to be directly connected to an amino acid other than the one kind of amino acid that it's allowed to carry. All right? And what determines the kind of amino acid that a given tRNA molecule is allowed to be directly connected to is a part of the overall sequence that this tRNA has, because it's like any nucleic acid, it has a sequence. Specifically, it's a triplet, a three nucleotide sequence, called its anticodon. And when I said earlier that there are different kinds of tRNAs that correspond to the different kinds of amino acids, what makes the different kinds of tRNAs different is their anticodons. Now, it's called an anticodon because the anticodon of a tRNA is complementary to the codon, which is part of mRNA. And remember that the genetic code is made up of codons. All 64 possible combinations of mRNA nucleotides make up the genetic code. We consider them, though, three nucleotides at a time or one codon at a time. Well, when you look at that code, each individual codon, other than the three that don't specify any amino acids, the stop codons, all the 61 that specify amino acids, each codon specifies exactly one specific amino acid. Therefore, a sequence that is complementary to the codon, which is what the anticodon of the tRNA is, specifies the amino acid that the codon specifies. And therefore, that kind of tRNA can never carry any other kind of amino acid directly. Okay. Well, we'll use different pictures to see how a tRNA can go from an aminoacyl to a peptidyl tRNA. But even a peptidyl tRNA is only directly connected to the one kind of amino acid it's allowed to carry. Okay, we see a little bit more detail in 13 of a tRNA. It is an mRNA. It is an RNA molecule, and like we've talked about before, unlike DNA, which is typically double-stranded, RNA is single-stranded. So this is just one sequence, one strand, even though it wraps back on itself. On the top, we have deformed it, gotten rid of the three-dimensional structure, and flattened it out on two dimensions. And we can see that it has the so-called cloverleaf shape because of these hairpin loops that it has that wraps the single strand back around on itself. So the sequence is complementary to other parts of the same sequence, and that's why it can make these hairpin loops. But it has a 3' end and a 5' end, just like any nucleic acid strand, and they just happen to be at both ends of the molecule because of this wrapping. Of those two ends, 3' and 5', the 3' is particularly important because that is the place on that given tRNA where an attachment with an amino acid can be made. So for an uncharged tRNA, it's just the 3' end. And that's the end of the molecule. For an aminoacyl tRNA, that amino acid that it's allowed to carry is connected to the 3' end. And the entire sequence, of course, is important because it allows it to have its shape. But the truly important part of the overall sequence are these three nucleotides that I was talking about earlier, collectively called the anticodon. And that anticodon corresponds to a codon, which specifies a certain amino acid. Well, this kind of tRNA can only ever carry that kind of amino acid directly. All right. 14. So what we have in a cell, in the cytosol, the liquid component of the cytoplasm, which is where translation occurs, is a whole population of tRNAs in all states of, in all possible states. Some of them are uncharged, some of them are aminoacyl tRNAs, and some of them are peptidyl tRNAs. But peptidyl tRNAs are only ever found at ribosomes, busy at the moment in the process of translation. Aminoacyl tRNAs are available not at the ribosome, just in the general cytoplasm. And they are, and you know, there's different kinds of tRNAs, but there's going to be many copies of each kind of tRNA, each one an aminoacyl tRNA carrying that particular amino acid. And they're basically just waiting for the codon that is complementary to their anticodon to come up in messenger RNA at a ribosome next. In other words, for their number to be called, in a sense, for their codon to be called, so that they can come in, bring that correspondingly appropriate amino acid to the ribosome so that it can be connected to the growing chain. There are uncharged tRNAs that are coming off of ribosomes because they have already transferred the amino acid they were carrying to the next tRNA coming in. And we saw that in the picture in 12. This one was carrying stuff. It transferred it over, and now it's being ejected from the ribosome. So the point of slide 14 is that there are these uncharged tRNAs that, for them to be able to do their job, need to be recharged. Appropriately recharged. It has to be a careful process because each different kind of tRNA has to be charged with that particular kind of amino acid that it's allowed to carry. And so this involves an enzyme, which isn't surprising, but it's not a single enzyme that does this for all kinds of tRNAs. It's a family of enzymes, and just as there are different kinds of tRNAs, there are different versions of this enzyme, each of which works with just one kind of tRNA to ensure that only the right kind of amino acid gets hooked on to each uncharged tRNA type. That all make sense? The enzyme itself is the gray thing that is shaped kind of like a human embryo. It's called, as you see, aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. Now, aminoacyl tRNA synthetase is not aminoacyl tRNA. It's just part of its name. It's a synthetase because it synthesizes or brings together two things. And the two things that it synthesizes are an uncharged tRNA of a particular type and the one kind of amino acid that it's allowed to carry. All right. So aminoacyl tRNA is the product of this. Because when you bring an uncharged tRNA into this enzyme, along with the appropriate kind of amino acid, and you hook them together, what you make, or what that enzyme makes, is amino acyl tRNA of a particular type. All right.
First, the amino acid comes in, and that's why you need different kinds of enzymes of this sort. This one works with only this kind of amino acid. And then the uncharged tRNA that's allowed to carry this kind of amino acid comes in, and what is made is a charged tRNA, but specifically an amino acyl tRNA. So this is happening all the time, recharging the ones that are being ejected by ribosomes so that they can then be used again when their codon gets called in the mRNA, if it does at all. There's just always a pool of all the different kinds of amino acyl tRNAs available. Let's take a closer look at the ribosome in 15. The top screen is kind of realistic in terms of shape, but it's harder to look at. It's easier to look at the cartoon version in the middle, even though, as I said before, this you wouldn't see these two ribosomal subunits together by themselves. As we'll see, they only come together after messenger RNA is already there. But it's good to just look at this simple picture to notice that the large ribosomal subunit features three slots. And in English, we read left to right, so it looks like they're E, P, and A, but that's actually the reverse order in which they're used. They're used A first, then P, then E. And these are just initials. As you can see, the A slot it stands for amino acyl tRNA binding site. That's where an amino acyl tRNA that happens to have an anticodon that is complementary to the codon that's being read in the A slot can come in. No other kind of tRNA can come in, and therefore this ensures that only the right kind of amino acid gets added next. So the A slot is you could think of that as where the next or the current codon is being read by the ribosome. The P slot is so named because it's the peptidyl tRNA binding site. Now, the way that a peptidyl tRNA gets created, because all tRNAs, when they're charged, start out as amino acyl tRNAs, is that when there are two tRNAs in the ribosome, as we see on the bottom here, one of which is just coming in and carrying one amino acid, it's an amino acyl tRNA in the A slot, then the amino acids, however many there are, one or more, it would start out with just one, carried by this middle one, get transferred to the amino acid carried by the amino acyl tRNA. And when that happens, it's not really happening here because it's a static picture, but if these four here get transferred to this one, now this one that's in the A slot is by definition going to be a peptidyl tRNA, right? And the one that transferred all of them away is now going to be an uncharged tRNA. Well, everything is then going to shift by one codon. The mRNA gets shifted by a codon with respect to the ribosome. So you can think of the ribosome as moving along the mRNA, or you can think of the mRNA as stringing through the ribosome. It's the same thing. But everything jumps by one codon. And that's what's going to put this one in the middle that is a peptidyl tRNA at the moment. It's going to make it an uncharged tRNA, but it's going to then be moved over to the E slot, which is short for either exit or ejection slot. The uncharged tRNA gets ejected. It's no longer part of this machinery, and now it just needs to go find its correct version of amino acyl tRNA synthetase enzyme to get recharged with the same kind of amino acid it's allowed to carry, in case the codon corresponding to that gets called up again. Okay? It's in general how it works, but let's look at a little bit more detail. Starting with 16.
I want you to think back to transcription. How many phases were there in transcription? The overall process of transcription occurs in how many phases? Three. Yeah, anyone know the names? They were initiation, elongation, and termination. Now, I mention that even though we're not looking at transcription here, because I don't want you to be confused by the fact that translation also occurs in three phases that have exactly the same names. But of course, it's completely different stuff happening, because one of the three-phase things is transcription, using DNA information to build an mRNA molecule. We've talked about that already. Now we're going to talk about initiation, elongation, and termination of translation, which uses the information in mRNA and a ribosome to build the polypeptide itself. Well, in slide 16, we're looking at just initiation of translation. And now you can see why I was saying it was a lie before, to show the two ribosomal subunits together by themselves. Really, what you have in the cytosol are many, many copies of small subunits, all identical, many, many copies of large subunits, all identical, and they're modular devices, so just randomly choose one small subunit and one large subunit, they're not necessarily ever going to be together again. Any small will work with any large. But before those two subunits come together, first, the small subunit comes together with the messenger RNA, as you see here. And the messenger RNA, remember there was an untranslated region before you got to the first start codon, or I should say the start codon. That's important for docking here. You have an mRNA binding site here on the small subunit, which recognizes part of this untranslated region before you get to the start codon. And that's really important because binding it to that will position the start codon perfectly at the position where there will be the P slot once the large subunit comes along. The reason that is so important, which we'll talk more about in a minute, is that you have to make sure you start reading three nucleotides at a time at the right position. All right? So that happens, plus the kind of tRNA that is allowed to carry methionine comes in. And I say that because remember that the start codon, AUG, does double duty, unlike the stop codons. The stop codons only tell the ribosome stop. They don't also code for amino acids. But the start codon, which there's only one of, AUG, not only says start, but it also codes for methionine, the amino acid. This is why all polypeptides start out with methionine as the first amino acid, even ones that shouldn't have methionine there. When it's appropriate for methionine to be the first amino acid, it's just left there. But some polypeptides need to have that methionine removed later because there's nothing they can do about putting it in there. It's the start codon that does that. Well, we talked about post-transcriptional modification of mRNA. There is also post-translational modification of polypeptides for various reasons. One reason is to remove methionine, since it just has to be there, but it really shouldn't be in all cases. Okay, so here we have a small subunit, the mRNA itself, positioned properly so that the start codon is in the corresponding position of the P slot, and a tRNA with an anticodon that is complementary to the start codon. See that AUG is the start codon here, UAC is the complementary anticodon, and it's carrying methionine. Well, then we have to spend some energy And we're used to talking about spending energy in the form of ATP, which is a nucleoside triphosphate, right? We've talked a lot about ATP, and it is the most frequently used nucleoside triphosphate for the purpose of carrying energy. But it's not the only one. GTP is used a lot as well. And it's just guanosine triphosphate. Very similar, except it, instead of using adenine as the nitrogenous base, it uses guanine. Guanine and the sugar, ribose, together make up the nucleoside called guanosine. Guanosine with three phosphates is GTP. It has energy just like ATP does, and for the same reason we cleave the phosphate to get some of that energy out. So GTP being spent turns it into GDP and inorganic phosphate. Now this should not at all surprise you that we need to spend energy, because this is a really expensive process to build a potentially huge molecule. Some polypeptides are only dozens or hundreds of amino acids long. Some of them are thousands of amino acids long. And we have to spend a lot of energy to build it, therefore, depending on how long it is. But the first place we spend energy is right here in initiation. And this allows for the, once all of this is in place, for this large ribosomal subunit to then finally come along and complete the ribosome. Matter of fact, this whole thing is more than just a ribosome. When it's all connected like this, we call it the translation initiation complex. All right. This is, notice, kind of an exception to what I was telling you before about A being used first and then P and then E. That's true for elongation, but initiation is an exception. And also notice that this tRNA that's in the P slot is actually not a peptidyl tRNA. This is only an aminoacyl tRNA, even though it's in the P slot. All right. Now 17 illustrates elongation of translation. And it's shown here as a cycle because it happens some number of times depending on the messenger RNA. The messenger RNA says how many times to go through this cycle because the messenger RNA has a certain number of codons, right? However many codons there are between start and stop, not including the stop, because the stop doesn't code for amino acids, but start and then all the other codons up to the stop, but not including the stop, tells the ribosome how many times you have to go through this elongation phase. It tells the ribosome how many amino acids are in the final product. And we've actually, we're looking at this a few steps after initiation. It's already gone through a few cycles here. You can see at the top, this thing is already a peptidyl tRNA. But it became a peptidyl tRNA when an incoming aminoacyl tRNA received amino acids from the previous tRNA. Okay, now that first one to come in was the AUG, the one that recognizes AUG in the previous one. Whatever the next codon is could be any of the other 61, or any of the 61, including another AUG. But that aminoacyl tRNA is going to come in. If this is the first one, not the one that we're looking at, but the first one in the previous slide, then it's going to transfer its one amino acid to the amino acid that's being carried in by this aminoacyl tRNA coming into the A slot. And that's going to make this a peptidyl tRNA carrying 2, right? Okay, well, then it shifts over. So each time it's going to add 1, and this just happens to be that it has 4 at the moment. But the process is expensive, as I was talking about, because it's anabolic. You're building up a bigger and bigger molecule each time you add an amino acid. So you have to spend GTP here. That allows, that provides the energy for the transfer of however many amino acids are being carried by the current P-slot tRNA to the amino acid of the aminoacyl tRNA in the A-slot. And when that happens, denoted by the red arrow here, That's going to change the categories of each of these tRNAs, right? This one that is currently a peptidyl tRNA, because it's carrying these four, will become uncharged. And this, and those four are going to be added to this one, making this current amino acyl tRNA a peptidyl tRNA carrying a 5 amino acid peptide. Okay, so if, at, just for a brief moment, down at the bottom here, they are really in the wrong slot according to what they are. This peptidyl tRNA is in the A slot. An uncharged tRNA is in the P slot. Nothing is in the E slot. But with the expenditure of another GTP, everything will shift by one codon. So that's going to put the now uncharged tRNA in the E slot where it should be, and then it leaves. It's going to put the new peptidyl tRNA in the P slot where it should be, according to the name of the slot. And it's going to leave the A slot open so that you can read the next codon. And that's going to call in one of the copies of that particular kind of tRNA carrying that kind of amino acid. So we spent one GTP for initiation. Notice we have to spend two more GTPs for every single amino acid that's added, times potentially thousands of amino acids for a big polypeptide. And then, as we'll see, we have to spend a little more for the final part, which is termination, shown in 18. Termination, meaning ending, occurs because eventually the next codon being read at the A slot will be one of the three stop codons. And remember that it does not matter at all which of the three stop codons comes up. They all have exactly the same effect. Well, unlike the start codon, which specifies an amino acid, none of the three stop codons specifies an amino acid. So there is no tRNA with an anticodon corresponding to a stop codon, because the job of tRNA is to carry amino acids. Stop codons don't specify amino acids. Instead of a tRNA coming in when the stop codon reaches the A slot, there is a special protein shown in yellow here that comes in called a release factor. Another use of the word factor to denote a special protein. And when that happens, that's the signal that will dismantle this whole translation complex. Okay? So the peptidyl tRNA that's in the P slot here already is carrying the entire polypeptide there, because the stop codon does not add another amino acid. And when the release factor comes in, the polypeptide, however long it is, which just depends on the gene that's being that was read originally, gets released from the tRNA. The uncharged tRNA gets released from the ribosomal complex. The release factor, well, the some more energy has to be spent in the form of GTP, a couple more, and that will allow the rest of it to be dismantled. So the two ribosomal subunits detach from each other, the mRNA detaches from the ribosome. But importantly, the ribosomal, I mean the mRNA does not get disintegrated itself. It just gets detached. In other words, the mRNA still is here. It still is information for how to make a polypeptide. It's still translatable, in other words. And so exactly the same thing can happen again for this same the same mRNA. It can be translated again to make an exact copy of the polypeptide that was just built. The reason this is important is because that's appropriate sometimes, but eventually it becomes inappropriate, specifically when you already have enough of that particular polypeptide. You wouldn't want to keep translating this mRNA to build more polypeptide when you don't need it, especially because it's so expensive. So mRNAs are not allowed to hang around forever in a cell. Otherwise, a cell would continue to make polypeptide after it's no longer needed. They work for a while, and then the cell digests them into individual RNA nucleotides, which can then be recycled into other kinds of RNA, or mRNA again, if it's whatever the need is for mRNA nucleotides. By the way, the cell doesn't have to be afraid at all of destroying this mRNA, which is information, right? Because when it does happen that that particular polypeptide is needed again by the cell, all it has to do is go back to the DNA library, to that gene, transcribe it, and transcription will produce an exact copy of the mRNA that got destroyed earlier. And you can make exactly the same kind of polypeptide by translating that new copy of the mRNA. All right, those are the particulars of translation. Now, in 19, we're looking at a way that cells have increased the efficiency of polypeptide production. So we have a single mRNA here, but notice that there are multiple ribosomes at different positions along the length of the mRNA, and each ribosome is translating that same messenger RNA and therefore creating its own copy. There are multiple copies in purple of the same polypeptide being produced. But the polypeptides are different lengths because they're in different stages of completion. Once all of these ribosomes get all the way to the end, all of the polypeptides will be identical. And so the point here is that why would a cell wait until a ribosome got all the way done with an mRNA before it started translating it again? As soon as a ribosome moves far enough along a messenger RNA so that there's room for another ribosome, it can start translating again and make another copy. Because the cell never needs one polypeptide. It will need thousands or millions of copies of that polypeptide. Okay, so it drastically increases the efficiency. But the name we give to the single mRNA and the multiple ribosomes that are simultaneously translating it is polyribosome. That can occur in both prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells. Now to 20. When we first started talking about ribosomes, which was the survey, a tour of the cell chapter, I gave you the phrases free ribosome and bound ribosome, which are identical. They're the same things, but in different times. Free ribosomes are ribosomes that are not connected to a membrane. Bound ribosomes are connected to a membrane. But ribosomes don't even exist, remember, as complete structures until translation is beginning. That's when the two subunits come together. And that always happens out in the cytoplasm. The initiation always starts in the happens in the cytoplasm, which means that all ribosomes, once they're formed, begin as free ribosomes. And that's where translation starts the process of building a polypeptide. Some, but not all, of those free ribosomes become bound ribosomes. And I say it's only some because some polypeptides do not need to be modified after they're built. There is no need, in some cases, for post-translational modification of the polypeptide. So they not only start on free ribosomes, the ribosome remains a free ribosome all the way through elongation and termination, and the polypeptide is ready to go for whatever it does. You know, the translation determines the sequence, but then the sequence, remember, determines all the other levels of protein structure, secondary, tertiary, and therefore it will do its job. Not all polypeptides are like this, though. Some need to be modified after translation. And we call that post-translational modification of polypeptides. So a big question, therefore, is how does the cell know which ones need help and which ones don't? What we see here in this picture is that it's actually part of the polypeptide that's being built. It's the first several amino acids that are coming off of this ribosomal assembly line that serve as a signal telling the cell, I'm one of those polypeptides that's going to need to be modified. Okay? So this happens on a free ribosome, because all this starts every time on a free ribosome. This green thing is just a sequence of amino acids, but that particular sequence tells the cell, take me over to the endoplasmic reticulum, which makes perfect sense, right? Because the job, specifically the rough ER, the job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is to modify newly made polypeptides. This sequence, whatever it is a signal peptide. A short sequence of amino acids is a peptide, and it's acting as a signal. All right. Well, as we've discussed, signals don't have any effect unless they can bind to a corresponding receptor. So the polypeptide being built here, that's one protein, or it will be once it's completed. This orange thing is a totally different protein doing the job of being a receptor for that particular signal peptide. And it's called a signal recognition particle, but it's a protein. All right. When you have the signal peptide binding to the signal recognition particle, that causes migration of this free ribosome, which is part of this translation complex, but the whole complex gets migrated over to the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And that is what gives the ER its roughness in appearance, right? Ribosomes. Well, there's a docking that takes place. So we've already involved two proteins. Well, really, more than that, because the ribosomes themselves are made of protein partially. But this signal recognition particle has another part on its shape that is just right to dock to a protein complex embedded in the membrane of the ER. And that protein complex forms a little pore. So that's what actually docks it. And at that moment, this is no longer a free ribosome. It's a bound ribosome. But the docking is such that it positions perfectly the emerging, still being translated polypeptide in a position that will string it right through that tunnel, that pore, and into the lumen, or the hollow interior, of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Exactly where it needs to be to get modified, whatever the modification is. The ER figures out what kind of modification needs to be done and performs it, as we've talked about, then packages it in a vesicle and sends it to the Golgi. Well, once that's done, once the ribosome has added the last amino acid and the stop codon comes in, this is no longer going to be bound to the membrane. It's going to detach again when the whole thing disintegrates. So when we look through a microscope at rough ER and see the roughness, that's just the current population of bound ribosomes. The next moment, it will be other ones coming in, and some of those will be removed because they're done. It's always a big turnover. But they all start out as free ribosomes. All right, now to 21. I want to talk a little bit about mutations. And in this chapter, as opposed to next unit, when we'll talk more about mutations, the mutations I want to cover in this unit are small-scale mutations. But first of all, any mutation, by definition, is a change to the DNA sequence. for whatever reason, just purely by accident or because of some chemical, like from cigarette smoke, from ultraviolet radiation, whatever, causes a change to the DNA sequence. It's called a mutagen, something that causes mutations. And the mutation is simply the new sequence, whatever it is, that is different from what it was. Well, keep in mind what I told you before. You have a hell of a lot of nucleotides in your DNA library, but most of them are not in genes. 99% of the DNA nucleotides are between genes in those non-coding regions. And so when mutations happen just randomly throughout life, it's most likely that they'll occur in one of these regions between the genes, which doesn't necessarily have any effect. But sometimes they'll occur just randomly in the middle of a gene somewhere. And that can cause different versions of proteins to be made versus what's supposed to be made. Okay? So we have here just the same example we've looked at before. One of the hemoglobin genes that can mutate into a different version that can cause sickle cell disease. So we've looked at this example before. But on the top we have the DNA. It's two-stranded, but remember only one of those two strands is used in the process of transcription. The template strand, in this case, is the top one, CTT. That's just one triplet of many. Okay? But the mutation is occurring in this particular triplet. Now, these really small-scale mutations that I'm discussing here are called point mutations because it's usually involves just one or a very small number of nucleotides. We use the phrase base pair, by the way, which of course is two. Well, it's two bases, meaning two nucleotides. The nitrogenous base is on two nucleotides. But it's really one position, one nucleotide, because the base pair is the nucleotide on one strand and the complementary nucleotide on the other strand. It's still just, in length, it's only one nucleotide. Okay, so anyway, before mutation, we have this wild type. That's a phrase that simply refers to the version that is found in the greatest number of individuals in a population, in a naturally occurring population. Okay, so wild type here, among the entire sequence, it has this triplet, CTT. When CTT gets transcribed, that's going to call for, with complementarity rules, GAA in the messenger RNA, right? And GAA, if you look it up in the genetic code, specifies glutamic acid as the amino acid. So that's why that's the amino acid that gets laid down in translation. And that leads to normal hemoglobin that does its job well of carrying oxygen and CO2. Well, here we have mutant DNA, and the mutation is a point mutation. It affects just this one nucleotide pair. Instead of CTT, it's CAT. Well, the cell doesn't know that it's a mutation. It's simply reading this new DNA. So it follows the same transcription rules, and CAT calls for GUA in the messenger RNA. Well, GUA, when you look it up, specifies valine instead of glutamic acid. All the other ones are correct, but this one valine makes a big difference, and it does not have the right shape, clumps together, doesn't carry oxygen and CO2 nearly as well, and causes the disease. So by analogy with language, it's like inserting the wrong word into a sentence, which can drastically change the meaning. A word like not, for instance. Do not step onto the third rail, as opposed to step onto the third rail. It could have totally different consequences. Let's continue this, though, in 22. These are point mutations as well. You have the wild-type DNA at the top. All these others are mutant versions. But there's two columns here. In the left column, we have what are called base pair substitutions. So base pair, remember, is one nucleotide in length. What makes it a substitution, though, is that instead of having what should be there in the wild-type, you're substituting it with a different nucleotide. It's a substitution, though, so you still have the same number of nucleotides in the DNA. Nothing is added or subtracted because you're just swapping one for the other. That's really important for a reason I'll get into once we get to the second column. But base pair substitutions can be categorized into subcategories depending on their effect. The same thing's going on. One nucleotide is changing, but it has different effects. For instance, in this top one, the wild type triplet here is CCG, but it mutated into CCA for whatever reason. Well, CCA gets transcribed into GGU as opposed to GGC in the wild type. But because of redundancy, the fact, remember, there's 61 codons and there's only 20 amino acids, so it's possible to have multiple codons specifying the same amino acid. GGC specifies glycine, and so does GGU. So this is a mutation, but you would only know it by looking at the DNA. It's called a silent mutation because exactly the correct polypeptide gets built anyway, and therefore does not have any effect because the trait is not caused by the DNA directly, it's caused by the polypeptide. Well, below that we have missense. Missense is like a sentence that does not make the correct sense because a word or more is wrong. So here instead of CCG, it mutates into TCG. That gets transcribed into AGC, which codes for serine instead of glycine. And this is just another example of the one we just looked at for sickle cell disease. It's missense because a word has been changed. That changes the meaning. That's analogous to an amino acid being changed and therefore changing the shape of the protein, therefore its function as well. Then we also have nonsense. This is the same thing happening except when the mutation occurs, it gets transcribed into a stop codon, which doesn't even... Well, there's two problems here. Not only does a stop codon not specify any amino acid, but it also tells the ribosome you're done, right? Even though there's supposed to be several more amino acids to be added. So this has a larger scale effect. Very unlikely that this prematurely shortened polypeptide is going to be able to have the right shape to do the job it's supposed to do. So that would be a harder one to survive. Now on the right, all of these are much harder to survive as well because these are called insertions or deletions. Insertions, of course, means that a nucleotide gets inserted in between two, but nothing's taken away. So it's not a substitution. Insertions and deletions both change the length of the gene. Insertions increase the length, deletions decrease the length. And the reason that is such a big deal is because it changes what we call the frame of reading, or the reading frame. Now, using English as an analogy, we have words, and codons are like words. The mRNA is like a sentence or a paragraph. The codons are like words. In English, we don't use words only that are three letters long. We have variable length words. But we can get away with this because we put spaces between our words, right? When you're reading a sentence, we know that a word begins and ends. No matter how long it is, we know it begins and ends where it does because there are spaces around it. There are no spaces in the language of mRNA. There are only nucleotides, which are like letters, right? But the reason that spaces aren't needed is because all words in messenger RNA language have to be three letters. So all you have to do is just count them by three. You don't need the spaces. As long as you start counting at the right position. And if you insert or delete a letter, a nucleotide, that is going to shift the frame of reading. That's why these are called frame shift mutations. All right? Let me just use a sentence as an example. It's fairly easy to come up with an English sentence that uses only three-letter words.
For instance, the big cat, 8, the red owl.
All right, that has a specific meaning.
Well, if we had an insertion mutation, that would be like putting, let's say, an X between the I and the G of big. That's going to turn the whole sequence into the BIX, GCA, TAT, ETH, ERE, DOW. You see that? Everything got shifted over one, but it's still reading it 3 at a time. And this is why the effect is so drastic, because an insertion or deletion will not only affect that codon, but all codons after that. And all of those amino acids will be wrong, which means you're basically making an entirely different protein, kind of a random protein, almost certain that it's not going to be able to do its job. The same thing would happen with a deletion, though. If we take the G out, it would turn into BIC, ATA, and so on. Well, this can operate in multiple ways. For instance, a frame shift can cause immediate nonsense, as you see here. If it turns it into a stop codon, then it's going to stop, and that's not going to work. It can cause extensive missense. That's what I was talking about there, where every codon after the mutation is going to be wrong. That's extensive missense. But on the bottom, notice that there is no frame shift if the mutation involves some multiple of 3. If you add 3 or take away 3, yes, it won't give you the right protein, but it would be like taking the whole word out here. It would turn it into the cat ate the red owl. If you take away 6, same thing. You wouldn't be shifting the frame unless it's not a multiple of 3. And usually it's 1, which is not a multiple of 3, so that has big effects. 23 now. Well, before we looked at polyribosomes, and I told you that those occur in both prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells, here we're looking at something that we eukaryotes can't do. And that's because of the fact that we have our two parts of gene expression, transcription and translation, occurring in different compartments. Not so in a prokaryote, though, right? What we have here in a prokaryotic cell is a single gene, the blue DNA, that has multiple polyribosomes attached to it. So in a prokaryotic cell, not only does the mRNA not have to be modified before it can go on to translation, like it does in us, the mRNA doesn't even have to be done being transcribed before it can start being translated. So this mRNA on the left, which is the youngest one, it's not yet done. As soon as it gets long enough for there to be room for a ribosome to clip onto it and start translating it into a polypeptide, that will start. Okay, so you're not done transcribing until you get all the way to the end. By then, you have many copies of the polypeptide already being built. And so this drastically ramps up the speed of production of polypeptides in prokaryotes, which could be potentially life-saving because you can't afford to lose a single cell if you are a single-celled organism. Number 24 is the last slide, and it's just a summary. So I'm done giving you new information. Let's just go through this, though. This is for a eukaryotic cell, which we've been concentrating on. So the blue stuff is the DNA, and remember that only one strand of the gene is used. That's the template strand. The template strand needs to be separated from the non-template strand, though, by RNA polymerase, which gets the job of transcription started. Once it separates, then the RNA polymerase reads the template strand one DNA nucleotide at a time and uses complementarity rules to lay down the corresponding or complementary
mRNA nucleotides one at a time,
creating the mRNA transcript.
But since this is a eukaryotic cell, that transcript needs to be post-transcriptionally modified in a couple main ways by adding the ends, the poly A tail and the 5' cap, and also, really not shown here, by splicing out the introns and hooking all the exons together, creating the mature version of mRNA, which, because of those ends that we put on it, is able to get out of the nucleus through nuclear pore to get to the cytoplasm where the ribosomes are so that translation can take place. DNA is done at this point. The two strands just go back together because they're still complementary. The mRNA then binds to a small subunit to start initiation. Then the larger subunit comes along, and elongation happens, as we described today, for as many times as there are non-stop codons that keep coming up. That will produce the polypeptide. The stop codon comes in and causes it all to disintegrate, and that can either happen entirely on a free ribosome, in the case of a polypeptide that does not need to be post-translationally modified, or the whole thing can be shifted over to the membrane of the ER so that the emerging polypeptide can be modified. And that's the units. Anyone have any questions about the unit before I stop recording? All right, well then don't forget a scantron form on Thursday.